Hello, welcome to the FinTech Newscast. My name's John, and with me, as always, is Steve. How are you doing?
I am doing well, John. How's it going with you?
Good, good. And just for the record, I do want to say Black Lives Matter.
Wow, look at you taking a stance, huh?
I will be brave and go ahead and say that, but not everyone is willing to take a stand, are they?
Is this the Coinbase story?
I think I gave away too much.
I think you might have, yeah.
Coinbase has a little bit of a mini exodus once they decided that they would be completely, as much as they can be anyway, a political non-activist company.
Right. So this what happened is that basically their CEO Brian Armstrong sent out a memo saying that the company's stance will be to basically remain apolitical in this environment, which is actually it's sort of counter to what you see with major corporations. Even everyone from banks and mom and shops has taken a stance on this, and his view is basically there should be no place for politics in the workplace. We're here for a mission, which is just whatever their mission is, crypto trading or whatever. But he said that if you do not agree with that, and if you want to sort of politicize the workplace, you're welcome to take a package and just leave the company. And as a result, something like 5% of their employees actually did leave the company and take the offer.
The big announcement, I think it was yesterday or the day before, was their chief compliance officer is leaving now, Jeff Horowitz. He's only been there about 2 years. He has great credentials. He was a good pickup for them, but he's gone. And it's not clear if this is the exact reason, but it is at the same time. He might have decided to go ahead and take the package and move on.
Yeah. What's your take on this, John? Do you think the company should actually be apolitical in their mission, or just have a focus and a mission and have sort of a social component, regardless of what space that they're in?
Well, I think traditionally the stance has been to be apolitical and just make money. In other words, well, I guess political in ways that would benefit the firm. And that was the kind of the Milton Friedman take. A company should focus on nothing but making money. And that's kind of turned corporations into kind of sociopathic, non-emotional, do anything it takes. Crush anybody, kill anybody, as long as you make money in the end, then it was worth it. And because money is the only way that a corporation can measure success or failure.
Yeah, what's interesting is that we've seen a lot of companies take the tack that they will now focus on ESG, right? Environmental, social, and governance issues. And this is kind of bucking the trend. It's really interesting. And it's also worth noting here, this is coming from a company that's heavily focused on, on Bitcoin and Ethereum and sort of the crypto world, which tend to have more of a libertarian worldview, right? So I think those two are related in a way. So it's an interesting approach. We'll see what happens, but that 5% turnover rate seems maybe a bit high for what it is.
Yeah, you wouldn't think it'd be more, huh?
I don't think so. Not during a pandemic, and not with a company that will go likely public in the next 2 years or so.
Yeah, I think bottom line for me is every company has a social impact, and you can choose to, make that a positive thing, or even if you're just seeking to make money and expand your business in an unlimited way, there are some negative externalities and consequences to that that I think people are. Have been pushing back against for a while. I don't know if you can be apolitical.
I don't think you can. Yeah, agreed.
You still have an effect on life, and it should be a positive one. So I don't know. I don't know if I buy it. But interesting, and something that every company has to go through. I mean, if they're deciding to do that, then at least they're being open about it and offering people a fairly generous severance package for people that to leave and that don't agree. And to kind of smooth the waters of whoever's left there. So it is pretty actually kind of honest of them. And so I guess you can applaud that. Yeah, fortunately, we have somebody that is helping our small and medium-sized business. I'm going to give you a slow pitch there. We have the CEO of Funbox, Prashant Filoria. Thanks for joining us on the podcast.
John, Steve, thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for joining us. And well, let's just start off with telling us what Funbox is and what you guys do.
Sure. Funbox is a fintech company that serves the small business economy through credit and payment solutions. So we are a financial platform that works with small businesses across different industries and verticals. And we help business owners by giving them financial flexibility and peace of mind through our financial products.
Now, this has been kind of a hot area and clearly one that's underserved. A lot of companies have done well and expanded services for small and medium-sized businesses. And now with the pandemic, some have run into trouble. How's the pandemic treated you guys?
Yeah, the pandemic has definitely been a very significant shock or event in the world of fintech. And we think it's almost a defining moment for fintech in the sense that it's simultaneously a big challenge and also a big opportunity. We've seen many companies have serious challenges in terms of serving their customers through the pandemic, and for some very good reasons. It's a pretty significant economic shock. There are all of these operational challenges in working through a pandemic. And we've seen companies that serve small businesses have increasing rates of delinquencies, a delinquency being not getting back funds that you were expecting to get back. And that is often spiraled out of control where this increase in delinquencies has led to all sorts of things like the fintech in question either pausing their operations or exiting the market altogether. Now, thankfully at Fundbox, the story has been quite different. We've continued operating through the onset of COVID and over the last 6 months without any disruption to our business. We've continued serving our existing customers through our credit and payment products, and we've also been acquiring new customers. And while there were some anxious few weeks in the onset of COVID where we were not sure how this would play out, things remained fairly calm. And just to give you a sense of the metrics around this, again, going back to delinquencies, which is an often used financial metric, which is like the percentage of payments you were expecting that you didn't quite get. Our delinquencies have historically been in the low single digit percentages. And they did spike, or they did sort of move up a little bit in the first few weeks of COVID to the high single digits, but then came down again and have really been at pre-COVID and now for the last couple of months at historically low, you know, pre-COVID levels. So that's worked out very well for us. But we've also seen folks, especially those that have public filings and that securitize and hence publish those reports, with delinquencies that have gone all the way up to 20, 30, 40, sometimes even 50%. So with catastrophic consequences, you know, on their business operations and their ability to serve their customers.
So what's the secret sauce here? Why do you guys have a much lower delinquency rate than your peers?
I think there are a few things that we've been doing, and the company's been around since 2013. So for the last 7 years, we've been building our product and our technology in a way that really has helped us navigate COVID. I think the number one thing that we've done and made a huge investment in is data. So when customers work with Fundbox, they connect some transactional system like their accounting software or their bank account to Fundbox that gives us a very rich understanding of their business transactions and their business health. And we've spent a fair amount of time and a lot of money. The data investment over the past 7 years is over $100 million in terms of the people and the technology and the data itself. We've invested a lot in being able to understand that data and make very, very good predictions using that data. And so as a result, when we started seeing these significant fluctuations in things like incoming revenue, for example, we were able to respond very quickly because all of this had been set up in our data infrastructure to be able to process very, very quickly and make good decisions. So I think the single biggest thing that we do very differently is our approach to data and how we use it. I think the other thing that we've also done is we're pretty diverse. So we're not focused on any one particular segment, like for example, B2C retail, which was hurt more than other segments during the pandemic. We've got professional services, we've got retailers, wholesalers, small manufacturers, contractors, folks in the construction space, literally the sort of the whole gamut of small business. So we're very diversified. And that diversification has also helped us quite a bit. I think the last thing I would say is, beyond all the technology and the diversification, there's also some good old-fashioned financial discipline. And what I mean by that is, especially when it comes to credit, it's relatively easy to give money away. It's harder to get it back. And it's not that difficult to build a big credit business because you're giving people money. But to do it in a way that is responsible, both for you and for your customers, is more challenging. So we've always been fairly careful about how we give credit. And frankly, I think coming into 2020, we could have been a business that is maybe twice our current size if we had been more generous and perhaps less careful with our credit. But then I probably wouldn't be sitting here talking to you. I'd be running around trying to sell the company.
Yeah. Yeah, if you've lent money to my family, then you'll know, yeah, it's very hard to get the money back, for sure. You know, you talked about the data and that investment, that large investment in that. Is there something that you would wish, if you could wish for some additional piece of data or insight that you would like to have?
I think we've got a fairly good handle on business health, because of our access to bank account data and to accounting software data. Mm-hmm. A lot of folks have built their predictions and their credit models based on more traditional consumer level data like personal credit history, which is good for evaluating a consumer, but is not very effective in evaluating a business. And so while we have access to a lot of different kinds of data, we find that access to business health through something that's more transactional, where you can actually see incoming revenue day over day, week over week, and then also expenses in different categories has been very helpful. And I think with the exception of, you know, if we knew when COVID was going to hit, right. I think, and that is of course like a black swan event, which none of us could have predicted. I think we were quite well set up from a data standpoint. And that actually helped us navigate the crisis, the COVID crisis, very well.
Interesting. So you plug in, you basically, the processes that you plug into the accounting software of an SMB, right? So like a QuickBooks, right? And it's interesting because I used to work in consumer lending. And one really interesting piece of that I saw is that there's a correlation between having low battery on your phone and being either unable or unwilling to pay something back to pay the loan back, either a credit card or a personal loan. And this is kind of an interesting insight into how other things can be used to sort of assess somebody's credit worthiness, right? And I'm wondering, from your perspective, other than getting data from QuickBooks, is there anything sort of like that, it's kind of a counterintuitive data point that can really inform whether or how much credit you give to an SMB?
I think that there is a lot of information and insight in your accounting software or in your bank accounts. The challenge is that making sense of it in an automated way is not easy. So for example, the books or the accounts of, let's say, a barber versus a small manufacturer versus a lawyer or a legal firm are all different. And while a skilled human being could understand a business and spend some time with their accounts and kind of make sense of how the business is doing, that has historically been hard to replicate in software. And that's what we've done. It takes the average bank about something like $3,000, it may be more now, to underwrite a business, because they need that underwriter, they need that auditor to actually go through someone's numbers and make sure that they make sense and derive some insight out of them. And now if you're a bank and you're selling a product, whether it's a loan or something else, to a mid-size, mid-market business, spending $3,000-$4,000 to assess them is not that big of a deal because you're selling them a multi-million dollar product on which you'll make hundreds of thousands of dollars in revenue. But if the customer is only looking for a $25,000 line of credit on which you might make a few thousand dollars over their lifetime, do you really want to spend $3,000 assessing them? The economics may not work out. So what we've done is, and this is, we've automated through machine learning the ability to extract that insight from those data sources. And that's the hard part, because this data is not proprietary in the sense that anybody can go and get somebody's accounting software data or bank account data, but how do you actually make sense of it in a very efficient way and make good predictions is the hard part. So that's what we've invested in.
Do you see this kind of capability as being useful for other products or expanding your business into other areas?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So one of the things that we do is we're building out an understanding of businesses and the connections between them. We call this the business graph. And as an example of something that has a lot of potential, even beyond our current, what we do currently, is we use this business graph, which as a way to understand the health of businesses. So imagine for every business that we bring on, and let's say they connect their bank account or their accounting software or both, or some invoicing system or any transactional system, we may learn something about the 100 other businesses that they're connected to, either as a vendor or as a customer. So even though we've got a few hundred thousand small businesses who are connected to us directly, we have some information, some insight around of over 10 million small businesses in the US. So we have information that can be very useful for things like benchmarking. Hey, are you paying more in your lease than a similar dentist in some, in a similar part of the US, for example? So benchmarking is a big deal. It's also like an early warning system that, hey, something's happening in your network that you should know about because that might have implications on your business. So there's a lot of potential for one, just informational products where we can give you some useful signals, insights, pieces of information that you can use to better run your business. There's also the possibility of other transactional products which involve moving money around, whether that may be to pay a vendor or to get paid by a customer. So there's a lot of potential, and obviously as still a young and small company, we have to prioritize and focus on where we can have the biggest impact.
Interesting. Any idea as whether you could potentially white label this solution? It sounds like you've sort of cracked the nut on underwriting, right? And understanding a business's health, but any plans to eventually go and sell this to other players in this space?
This is a debate that we have every so often here at Fundbox. If you think about Fundbox in a very, very simple way, you can think of us as sort of having two parts. One is sort of the technology, the engineering, the data science, the machine learning, which is a very, very important part of Fundbox. And then the other part is how we actually work with customers, which is what does the product look like? How do we provide customer service? What does our brand mean to the customers that we serve? We're not a household name today, but the customers who come to Fundbox and use us have a very positive association, with us. Now, when we think about the future of the company and all of these opportunities, and by the way, COVID has just amplified the opportunities available, we think about the question you just asked: do we license our technology to other players, or do we focus more on building our own brand and our own customer base? And for the most part, I would say that we're a lot more focused on the latter. We believe that there is some value in not just the technology, which is, don't get me wrong, it's very, very important, But in combining the technology with the right product design and the right customer service and the whole thing put together, which I think is very valuable. So way many, many years ago, when I was a young man, I was a young product manager at Google. This is the year is 2003. And Google had a similar, Google was doing very well as an independent search engine, but it also had the question of how much it should invest in powering search for other properties like Yahoo and AOL. And again, I may be dating myself by referring to sort of something that was 17 or 18 years ago.
Yahoo?
What's AOL?
But it is interesting that Google decided that it was much more important to continue to have its own brand, its Google.com as a destination for users, that direct connection with their users. And while they continued to power search on other sites, and of course the rest is history, as we all know, the focus of the company was on Google.com. And maybe not in as spectacular a way as Google, but I think in our own way, we believe that we can create more value, we can definitely have more impact by working with customers directly. So while licensing technology is definitely not out of the question, and we partner with folks in various ways, I think our primary focus is to work with our customers directly.
Got it. If we can kind of zoom out here, there's been a lot of, there's been some flux in the online lending space, right? We saw Lending Club hasn't had a successful run in the market. OnDeck sold at a price significantly lower than it actually IPO'd at. We've seen issues with Funding Circle as well in the UK. What is your take on the evolution of online lending, either personal or SMB? And why do you think Fundbox has been able to succeed and weather these storms in the past, call it 13 years or so?
I think that's a very good question. And I think that going back to, it involves going back to the basics of, are you able to serve a customer well? And are you able to retain them over a long period of time? And what is sort of your competitive differentiation, if you will? So we believe, and in fact, we don't just believe, it's a known thing that credit, whether it's consumer or small business, is a very, very, very major industry. It's a very big market. It drives a very large part of the financial performance of both traditional and new institutions. I think that one of the reasons why the fintech 1.0s, call it, if I may call them that, have not really succeeded that much is that they've innovated, or they innovated in some ways, but not quite completely. What I mean by that is, by being early to get onto the internet and to acquire customers online, they achieved some growth that your traditional banks were not able to. And so were able to attract some customers, but typically the products didn't necessarily have great retention. So that's one, were people coming back? And the second thing is, were these companies really making better decisions on customers? And I think, especially on the latter point, there was a time when everybody was talking about AI and machine learning, and it's very easy to talk about them. There's a joke going around in Silicon Valley that if your code is in Python, you call it machine learning. If it's on a PowerPoint slide, you call it artificial intelligence, right? So it's easy for you and for me and for everybody to talk about AI, but in reality, I think, were you actually using your data? How much care had you put into using it and getting benefit out of it became pretty apparent with COVID. And literally when we started seeing how some of the folks in the market were performing, then you realize that in the credit world in particular, a rising tide can lift all boats. When you're in a benign environment, everybody can can originate, can lend, and can generate revenues. But that just turns when the market turns. So I think that there is going to be a separation, and you're seeing that already in the market. I think that you're going to start seeing players that are more, the players that have really invested in building something truly different actually succeed. And I think at Fundbox, the combination of our approach to data, but then also how we present credit to customers. So one of the things we didn't talk about very much was you can come to Fundbox, our website or our mobile app, and get access to credit, and we do that. But we also are embedded inside of the business workflows of different SaaS applications. So for example, we are embedded inside of QuickBooks. And that's one of the integrations that we have where if you're a QuickBooks customer, you can actually see Fundbox right inside of your QuickBooks software, or inside of FreshBooks or other accounting and invoicing systems, or and so on. So we also present credit in different ways, and that's another way in which we're driving more retention, more usage. And so it's both a combination of sort of the user experience and the data and how it's used that I think will drive long-term winners in the market.
Yeah, hopefully you'll be one of them and you'll come back before you do your IPO on the show. So are there any fintechs that you see out there doing anything that you find especially interesting besides Fundbox?
I think that there is a lot of innovation happening right now in the world of fintech. And I think more broadly, here's how I see the future of fintech. I think there's an opportunity for fintech to really grow by reimagining financial products. And what I mean by that is your traditional bank has a set of tools, call it a bank account, a payment card, a loan or a line of credit. And these tools are what the bank has. And they offer these tools to customers, but those tools often don't understand the customer context. So an example of that would be if, for example, you've invoiced a customer who is a very loyal customer whom you've been working with for the last, let's say, 10 years, your bank account has no idea if that incoming check or wire or ACH is coming from a trusted customer against an invoice or just some other random inflow of cash. So it really cannot do anything on that financial transaction, like, for example, accelerate the incoming flow of funds because this is from a trusted source. Or conversely, if you're making a payroll run, realize that this is a really important transaction that should go through at all costs because making payroll in your company is like a really big deal. So these are the kinds of ways in which the current financial products are oblivious to the realities of the business. So I think there's this huge opportunity in making these financial products smart by understanding the business and then creating these really useful products and services for business users. And I think that you're going to see a lot of that happening maybe from banks, but we're seeing more of that from tech platforms. And you see that a little bit in the consumer space where there are a lot of efforts to innovate on banking, on payments, on credit at the point of purchase. And you'll start seeing some of these in the world of small business platforms and as well. So it's going to be a very interesting next few years where I think you'll be seeing a number of new services being coming to the table that should really map well to the needs of small businesses, as opposed to simply the metaphor of you have a hammer and everything is a nail. I think you're going to see a lot of change there.
Interesting. So you mentioned before that you came from Google as well as Facebook. How do you feel about the threat or the potential for all these massive tech companies, as you alluded to, sort of entering the space, right? It seems like whenever Amazon makes a play in the space, there's you know, stocks fall, people sort of get scared because they're a massive behemoth with all these flywheel effects. But what is your take on the SMB lending space as a potential target for these massive tech companies?
So I think that the small business payments and credit space is first of all, it's huge. Just to put this in perspective, there are about $1 trillion of unpaid invoices sitting around, which means that small businesses, there are a number of small businesses that are owed in totality about $1 trillion in receivables. That's a very, very large number.
Wow.
And
yeah.
It on an average, it takes one of these like B2B small business serving other businesses, like about 120 days to get paid, which is incredible, right? It's incredibly large. And so I think that there's a very large market, number one. Number two is it's very fragmented. And this is where I might draw a slight distinction between B2C and B2B. So B2C businesses, of course, are those that serve consumers like restaurants or you know, your yoga studio or anything like that, right? But B2B are ones where it's a small business serving other businesses. What most people don't know is that out of the 30 odd million small businesses in the US, only about 10 million are B2C. The remaining 20 are actually B2B. And you and I as consumers don't know that because we don't see them. We walk down Main Street, we see the restaurant, we see the grocery store, but we don't really see all the cleaning services and the food supply services and the staffing services for the restaurant, right? We don't see the B2B that much, but it's a huge market. It's hugely fragmented. And unlike the world of B2C, where you're starting to see some platforms starting to grow, like Square, for example, in retail payments or PayPal or what have you, there really isn't a dominant platform, far from that, in the world of B2B. And so it remains a very, very fragmented space. Over time, will platforms grow and consolidate across SMB? I think the answer is yes. Is it an opportunity for folks like Fundbox to become larger platforms? Absolutely. And I think that's how we're thinking about the future ourselves, which is how do we grow our impact, both in terms of the number of customers we serve, which would be awesome, and we're very happy about that, but also grow in terms of the kinds of services we provide and sort of to get to be broader and to serve, you know, just a broader set of needs for our customers.
Hey, has it been hard to hire people during the pandemic, or is it easier because you're doing remote and hiring from anywhere in the world?
So it's interesting. I think on the one hand, it's not been difficult to hire. We've continued hiring people through the pandemic. I think a bigger question in my mind is what happens to people whom you hire? Now at Fundbox, and again, we're a relatively small company, so I can think of the dozen people we've hired and know their individual sort of stories. At Fundbox, what I found is that it's been relatively easy for new hires to come in and assimilate. And even though they've never met anybody in person, build up those working relationships over video. I think it's worked out relatively well. But I have heard in some larger tech companies that shall be unnamed, but ones where I've worked at in the past, that new hires have had challenges. And there's been this concern from new hires that they're not being included in all the conversations. Maybe not through malice, but just through the fact that, you know, people just don't know about them.
Established
relationships, exactly. So I think it's possible that in a large company, where it's easy to get lost, right? If you're in a 10,000 person organization, you can get lost pretty quickly. That can be an issue. At Fundbox, look, we're a 200 person company, so like, we know everybody else. Like there's no hiding at Fundbox. Like you're working with everybody across the company. So it's a little bit easier, I think. So it hasn't been an issue for us, but I don't think that's necessarily the case across the board.
Well, it sounds like you guys are doing a great job. Keep up the good work. And thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Well, thank you so much for having me. Really appreciate it.
That's the CEO of Fundbox, Prashant Filoria. Please hit subscribe to keep up with the latest in fintech news, and thank you for listening.